I feel like this week was actually a really good example of the EU doing something that like gets noticed by normal people.
Are you talking about the new universal charging cable thing?
I am talking about the new universal charging cable. We are going with the USB-C as the socket of Europe. We're going to use it for everything as of 2024. It's very exciting, Dominic.
I'm so excited. No, I actually do think it's a really good idea. It was so annoying how many different chargers I've bought over the past decade.
I do also think it's the nicest of the USB shapes.
Why?
It's very sort of chubby and pleasing looking. I'm sure that's not why they chose it. But it does seem like, yeah, very good news. I saw one viral tweet that described this news as the sexiest technological development of the past decade. So we have the EU to thank for that.
I'd like to give the EU one other job, and that would be to insist that smartphones keep having normal headphone sockets.
Yes.
Because I don't want my headphone wire to have to be a USB-C. I find that really annoying.
We also had some headphone issues in our interview this week. And
that's true.
Bluetooth headphones are to blame for the sound quality of this week's call. Who was that call with, Dominic?
Well, this week we're going to be talking about spyware, which is something that was at the top of the headlines for a while back in the summer of 2021, when I'm sure you will have all heard about the Pegasus Project, this huge international investigation exposing widespread controversial use by governments of Pegasus, this incredibly powerful spyware that can take over your phone without you even knowing it, read all your messages you've ever received or sent, and even turn on your microphone and camera to snoop around in whatever's happening in your life. Our guest today is someone who was a victim of a government-backed cyber hack, the Hungarian investigative journalist Szabolcs Pányi. We've been wanting to find time to speak to Szabolcs for a long time, and this week seemed like the perfect time to speak to him because he has just released a new investigation uncovering the story behind how the Hungarian government procured this very controversial spyware technology. So he'll be joining us later on in the show to talk about all of that and to tell us what it was like to discover that he, an investigative journalist, was under the surveillance of the Hungarian government.
That is coming up later, but first.
Who has had a bad week, Katie?
Well, something very strange happened to Germany's train network over the weekend. Saturday morning, the entire train network across a big chunk of the north of the country just ground to a halt. No trains for about 3 hours, which is a deeply annoying thing to happen for people who were like, you know, planning a weekend trip to Berlin or Hamburg or wherever. There were huge queues at ticket desks at train stations, all of these upset passengers wondering what the hell was going on. Just chaos.
I mean, that happens pretty regularly in the Netherlands, but was there a specific reason for this?
I feel like every country has gripe with their train network.
It's true.
But still, this was surprising and unusual. And eventually it turns out that someone has taken a big pair of scissors. I mean, well, probably not scissors, but like a cutting device. Someone has taken a big pair of scissors and they have cut 2 fiber optic cables. One in Hohenschönhausen, which is a suburb to the northeast of Berlin, and the other in a town called Herne, which is on the other side of Germany to the west, quite near the Dutch border. And the effect of cutting these 2 cables is that this communication system that is used so that trains can communicate with the control centers, that communication system breaks down across 4 states in northern Germany. So the trains can't talk to the control centers. That means they can't operate safely. And Deutsche Bahn, which is the national railway operator, they have no choice but to suspend all of the trains in the northern part of the country. They do manage to get them back up and running by the afternoon. But in total, the trains were, out for about 3 hours across a really big swathe of the country.
So if these cables were cut with these giant scissors that you're talking about...
I don't know about the scissors.
It must have been a deliberate attempt. It must be some kind of sabotage, right?
Yes, this is definitely deliberate. We are looking at a mysterious case of sabotage. And we don't know who did this, but whoever did do it, officials say they must have had a really good knowledge of how this train communication system works. Mm. Like, to know that cutting these 2 random cables in quite different parts of Germany would bring a huge part of the train network to a halt, that's some pretty impressive knowledge.
And so let me guess, they might be thinking it's Russia?
Well, yeah, that is, of course, what everyone's been thinking. Whoever sabotaged the German train network last weekend, they managed to put it off very soon after another dramatic bit of unclaimed sabotage, which is these very mysterious explosions on the Nord Stream gas pipelines. So you probably saw these crazy images at the end of last month of these huge bubbles appearing in the Baltic Sea. And these bubbles, it turned out, were being caused by these massive gas leaks in the Nord Stream gas pipelines, which connect Russia to Germany. Environmentally, that is a disaster. Scientists are still trying to work out just how much methane has just leaked into the sea, but it seems to be the equivalent of the annual emissions of millions and millions of cars. It is just devastating for the environment. And again, we don't know who did it, but we do know that it was deliberate. Denmark and Sweden, the countries whose waters the explosions were in, they say it looks like hundreds of kilos of explosives were used to do this damage. And of course, these being pipelines between Russia and the EU, and with everything that's been going on with Russian gas supplies to Europe because of the war, immediately suspicion fell on Russia as the culprit of these gas pipeline explosions. Putin, of course, has denied this and even blamed the West for the explosions. We're not going to listen to him because he is a mass murderer. But anyway, yeah, as you say, in light of the mysterious attack on the gas pipelines, as soon as the German train sabotage happened on Saturday morning, everybody started thinking, is this Russia? However, at present, the German police have said that they can't find any evidence that there was a foreign state involved in this. And the federal police have handed over the investigation to state police, which you wouldn't expect them to do if they were still seriously considering the idea that this was done by Russia.
Sounds like they need Bellingcat to get involved.
Yeah, come and help us, please, Bellingcat.
If it wasn't Russia, is there anyone else in the frame?
I mean, I don't know. I am like so gripped by this mystery. There was this early theory that it might have been someone trying to steal cabling, because that's the thing that thieves do sometimes. Except for the fact that these cables were cut in two very specific places at the same time. So
yeah, on the different sides of the country.
Exactly. So that theory looks pretty unlikely. My husband and I were speculating about the possibility that this could be like an Ocean's 11 type thing, where criminals do something very spectacular to distract everyone while they like quietly do a heist or something. The next best theory is that a far left group could be behind this, because there's been a couple of spates of sabotage on the German train network that authorities, at least, have linked to leftist groups. Back in 2011, there was a series of small-scale explosives found on German train tracks, and a group called Heckler Reception Committee, Initiative for More Social Eruptions. It's a very catchy name. They claimed responsibility for it. They said it was in protest over Germany's role in the war in Afghanistan. And then in 2017, there were a bunch of arson attacks on rail lines just before the G20 summit in Hamburg. And a claim of responsibility got posted online from a group called Shutdown G20. They said they attacked the trains because railways are the central nervous system of capitalism.
Oh.
Which like strikes me as a bit odd. Like most left-wing people quite like trains. Like yeah. They don't seem to me to be the most evil bit of capitalism. But anyway, yeah, the police said that that claim of responsibility appeared to be authentic. And this idea that the latest attack over the weekend was done by left-wingers is now being floated again. I will say that in general, the reports linking left-wing extremists to German train attacks in recent years, they've been a little vague on the details. They're kind of like, leftist groups are thought to be behind this kind of thing, without really giving that much in terms of sourcing or evidence. And in terms of the most recent incident, this is really just a theory. At the time of recording, there is no evidence connecting it to a specific left-wing group. So we really don't know who did this. And it seems strange to me to carry out an act of sabotage and not claim it. I don't know, maybe this was a test. Maybe it was someone trying to see if it would work. And I think this is the alarming thing. It did work. And in general, the last few weeks have really been a wake-up call for just how vulnerable our infrastructure is. Like, we rely on cables that allow Europe's trains to run. We rely on underwater gas pipelines not exploding. And yet both of those things have been attacked successfully over the past few weeks. It is something that seems to be on the minds of EU leaders. They talked about it a fair amount at a summit in Prague last week. How do we protect our infrastructure better, especially against Russia? Several countries have already reinforced patrols around their energy infrastructure, like Norway and Finland and Denmark. And a lot of security experts are now asking themselves, like, what might be next? Maybe our internet cables. That would be pretty disastrous because we wouldn't be able to make this podcast.
Oh my God, I hadn't even thought about that. Mm-hmm. I feel like the fact that no one has claimed it is the one of the things that makes me think it's Russia the most, because that's kind of what they want, to, for people just to be generally afraid.
Yeah.
And for the West to feel vulnerable to them.
Well, it seems to be working.
Yeah.
On that front, depressingly. Who are you giving Good Week to this week?
Well, I'm saying it's been a good-ish week, maybe potentially, for the growing protest movement in Europe against Qatar's human rights abuses in the run-up to the FIFA World Cup. That's soccer for those of you on the other side of the Atlantic. And the World Cup will start in just over a month in Qatar. So now is a moment when people seem to be announcing exactly how they are going to acknowledge the controversies around Qatar's hosting of the biggest football tournament in the world. I don't know if these protests or gestures are really enough to warrant Good Week for the protest movement, but let's have a look at what's out there and then you can decide for yourself whether this topic has been correctly labelled as Good Week or not.
Okay. Could you maybe start us off by like reminding us about like what are the controversies and criticisms that Qatar has had in the run-up to the World Cup?
First, I should probably say that Qatar are going to be the first Middle Eastern country to host the World Cup. That's something that FIFA are framing as an important development. And there is the hope that it will help bring football to a wider audience and a part of the world where football isn't as popular as some other parts of the world. Qatar itself didn't actually have much of a footballing culture before they won hosting rights for this tournament. So there is the hope that the tournament will change that. Of course, you'll probably be aware that the World Cup is normally held in summer months. This would not have been possible in Qatar due to the very high temperatures in the summer months. So
yeah, right.
FIFA made the unprecedented decision to move it to winter. How Qatar came to win their bid to host the World Cup is a whole big story that I won't go into in detail now, but I'm sure everyone has at least vaguely heard about the allegations of Qatar maybe buying their way into winning this bid. Qatar deny this and FIFA deny this. They actually held a 2-year investigation looking into the allegation and ruled that there were no significant concerns. But for many, Qatar should never have been awarded the World Cup due to their human rights record, and in particular due to the way that migrant workers are treated in the country. Migrant workers who built the huge infrastructure for this tournament, including 8 new football stadiums, a new airport, a new metro system, and around 100 new hotels.
Migrant workers are like a massive proportion of the Qatari workforce, right?
Yes. According to Amnesty International, there are about 1.7 million migrant workers in Qatar, and they make up about 90% of the country's workforce.
Wow.
The migrant workers working on the World Cup infrastructure have mainly traveled from Bangladesh, India, Nepal, and the Philippines. And their working conditions have, by all accounts, been pretty atrocious. Pete Patterson in The Guardian has done so much excellent reporting on the terrible conditions for migrant workers in Qatar. So I really recommend you check out his work there over many, many years. But to briefly summarize the kind of things that Qatar are accused of, there have been allegations of forced labor from Amnesty International. There have been reports of overcrowded and squalid living conditions, incredibly low pay, and disturbing numbers of deaths amongst the migrant workers.
How many people are we talking about in terms of the deaths?
Well, it's been really difficult for journalists and aid organizations to work out exactly due to gaps in the data that Qatar provide and the fact that they don't, for example, list deaths due to respiratory conditions or heart failure as being work-related, even if they happened at work, and even if heart and respiratory illnesses are significantly worsened by workers having to work in these extremely hot conditions in Qatar's summer. The Guardian reported early last year that 6,500 migrant workers had died in Qatar since the World Cup was awarded.
Jesus.
But as I said, there are millions of migrant workers working there. So not all of them have been working on the World Cup infrastructure. Not all of them have died because of work. And it's pretty difficult to work out what the numbers are. But we know that a lot of them have been there because of the World Cup infrastructure projects. The International Labour Organization published a report just under a year ago in which they suggested that 50 foreign labourers had lost their lives in 2020. 500 were severely injured and a further 37,600 suffered mild to moderate injuries. So quite a big range in numbers there. We don't really know, to be honest.
And has Qatar actually done anything to improve the conditions, given all of the criticism it's had over this?
Well, they have made some reforms that, at least in theory, should have improved some of the worst aspects of the conditions for migrant workers, thanks to protests from migrant workers themselves and the international pressure. In particular, the controversial kafala system has now been scrapped. This is a long-running system under which employees weren't allowed to change employer, and employers could actually confiscate the passport of their workers, blocking them from leaving the country. The country also introduced a minimum wage, the equivalent of around €9 a day. This is one of the richest countries in the world per capita, if not the richest country in the world. So that minimum wage is pretty shocking.
Shocking.
And Pete Patterson's latest reporting in The Guardian has shown that conditions for migrant workers are still pretty dire despite these reforms.
So it sounds like there's still plenty to protest about. What do those protests look like in Europe right now? What's been happening?
Well, let's start with the Danish team. They have made one of the most eye-catching announcements. They unveiled a third kit for their players after their usual red kit and white kit. They revealed that they would also play in an all-black kit in memory of all the construction workers who lost their lives. Teams are not allowed to make explicit political statements with their clothing during the World Cup, according to FIFA rules. But so far, it seems like Denmark and their kit makers, Hummel, will be allowed to make this statement.
Isn't there also this One Love rainbow symbol thing that's going to appear on lots of the kits?
Yeah, that's another initiative that's been spearheaded by the Dutch Football Association, whereby players will have a rainbow heart on their sleeves with the words One Love, a general anti-discrimination message which can't help but be read in reference to the terrible conditions for LGBTQ plus people in Qatar. Mm-hmm. Consensual sex between people of the same sex is punishable by prison of up to 3 years in the country. And according to a report from the US State Department, homosexuality could actually still officially be punishable by death. But it seems that there haven't been any executions for this reason in Qatar's recent history. Still pretty terrifying that it's a possibility.
How has the government in Qatar responded to all of this like criticism over the way that LGBTQ plus people get treated? Because presumably there are going to be people of that demographic attending this huge tournament.
Yeah, presumably there will be. I mean, I wouldn't want to personally.
But you love the sports.
But it feels, yeah, even if I did love football that much, I think I wouldn't want to go. But I think it feels pretty awful to think that a tournament would be unavailable to me because of my sexuality. So I understand why braver people than me would take the risk and go. It seems like the Qatari authorities are going to be suspending some of the horrible legislation against LGBTQ plus people. I mean, that's at least according to the English Football Association, who have been apparently assured that LGBT couples will not be prosecuted for holding hands in public.
Yay.
Hooray. Anyway, this One Love armband will be worn by 10 teams so far: the Netherlands, England, Belgium, Denmark, France, Norway, Sweden, Germany, Switzerland, and Wales. Some campaigners think that this statement doesn't go far enough and is a bit weak. But yeah, other people have defended it. England manager Gareth Southgate said recently, yeah, well, there is a limit to what can be achieved. Also on the LGBT rights front, the German Football Federation recently invited a gay fan to address the Qatari ambassador at a congress that they were hosting. He made a really powerful statement to the ambassador. His name is Dario Minden.
I'm a man and I love men. I do, please don't be shocked, have sex with other men. This is normal. So please get used to it or stay out of football. Because the most important rule in football is for everyone. It doesn't matter if you're lesbian, if you're gay, it's for everyone. For the boys, for the girls, and for everyone in between.
That's very beautiful.
Yeah, I found it quite powerful and quite moving, actually. Of course, some people think that because of the human rights record and the record around LGBT rights, that teams should actually be boycotting the World Cup. Mm-hmm. That, so far, isn't happening. But in the past week, there were some boycott announcements from cities in France who have decided not to show the matches in public spaces or set up these fan zones as they normally would do.
Yeah.
The mayor of Lille, one of these cities, said that the tournament in Qatar was, quote, a nonsense in terms of human rights, the environment and sport. So Lille, along with Paris, Marseille, Bordeaux, Reims, Nancy and Rodez have all decided not to participate in the World Cup celebrations.
It is good to see these gestures of like solidarity and protests, but do you think that all of this will make much of a difference in the end?
Yeah, that's the question. And I don't really have the answer, to be honest. As I said before, many people believe that Qatar simply should not have been allowed to host this competition. Yes, there have been some improvements in migrant worker conditions, but has it been enough and will it last? Amnesty International say it hasn't been enough. And even if some anti-LGBT laws will hopefully be suspended during the tournament, that doesn't really seem like enough in exchange for Qatar being able to present itself as this friendly football hosting nation. So I think the protests are important simply to remind us all that even if we really get into this tournament and enjoy the football watching it, the hosts should not be let off the hook for some pretty atrocious human rights conditions in their country. One idea that's being floated by Amnesty International is the setting up of a compensation fund for migrant workers who have suffered in the run-up to the tournament and for the relatives of migrant workers who have died. Mm. The suggestion is to match the World Cup prize money, a sum of around $440 million, to fund compensation for abused migrant workers. Support for this idea seems to be growing, and it certainly has the backing of public opinion, according to polling conducted by Amnesty. And it feels like it would be an appropriate response to what has been a pretty shameful build-up to the tournament.
Last week, we floated this idea that since this podcast is celebrating its fifth birthday next month, some of you might want to buy us a birthday present in the form of a donation so that we can pay our producers and keep making this podcast. And I was super, super touched by how many people have already sent us birthday presents this week. Yay! Who are these lovely people, Dominic?
Thank you so much, all. Their names are Maya, Madeline, Johannes Rave, Zoltan Urban, Cormac Flynn, Maya Benyami, Inga Run Helgadottir and Nils Skjöld. Our birthday isn't for another few weeks, so there's still time to join this lovely, lovely group of people who have kindly agreed to give us a birthday present that we rather needily requested for ourselves and help secure the future of this independent podcast for many more years to come, hopefully. Head to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast and you can donate as little as 2 smackers a month.
Thanks, everyone. Back in the middle of last year, you might remember a little scandal that affected basically every country around the planet. It was a scandal over a piece of software called Pegasus, an incredibly powerful piece of software, it turns out. If it was installed on your mobile phone, this software would allow whoever was on the other end to see everything on your phone. The contents of your messages, even on programs like WhatsApp that are supposed to be secure and encrypted. This other person could see your photos, they could see your contacts, they could read your Facebook messages, your emails, everything. And it turned out that a variety of law enforcement agencies around the world had bought this software, which is made by an Israeli company called NSO. And they were using Pegasus not just to track criminals and terrorists, but also to spy on human rights activists, journalists, and government opponents, the good guys. Here in Europe, NSO itself admitted that it sold the spyware to authorities in at least 5 EU countries. We still don't know which ones, but one country where Pegasus was definitely used was Hungary. And one of the people who knows that their phone was hacked by the Orbán government is Szabolcs Pányi. Szabolcs is a journalist working at the investigative website Direct36. He's someone whose work that we really admire and someone who we've been wanting to talk to on the show for ages. His most recent investigation looks at how the Hungarian government was able to get hold of this incredibly easily abused tool in the first place. And it seemed like a good moment to get Szabolcs on the show. Unfortunately, the sound quality of this call was not amazing. We did ask the Hungarian government if we could use their recording of our conversation, but they haven't sent it to us yet.
Bad joke.
Bad joke. Let's move on. Here's Szabolcs. I wondered if you could take us back to the moment when you found out that Orbán's government had had you under surveillance for months, like had total access to your mobile phone. What did that feel like? It must have felt very strange to see your name on that list alongside those of criminals.
I really freaked out because I was instantly afraid of my sources. All the names were running through my mind with whom I was in touch with, who gave me confidential information about certain, you know, corruption issues, who leaked me some documents. And I was really afraid that, you know, those guys could have gotten into trouble. So that was really a bad feeling, the worst feeling in my life, actually. And then later when I saw this database and on the same list, there were like phone numbers belonging to criminals who were active in the 90s, engaged in like violent crimes. And then to see my name next to them being put in the same bracket, that was clearly pretty infuriating. In someone's sick mind, I pose the exact same threat as the worst criminals, that they want to deploy the same military-grade spyware against me. That was pretty horrifying. But, you know, at the same time, it was also like a badge of honor to see that someone actually thought that I'm so important, that I'm worthy enough to become a target of Pegasus, this spyware that's just hugely expensive. I mean, to surveil a single target, that could have costed back then around like $50,000, I think. That's more than my annual salary. And what makes it even worse, and that this money was actually paid by taxpayers. So, you know, they just took the money from one of my pockets to pay for spyware that they then used against me. Yeah, that's it.
Did you ever work out what information they were trying to obtain from your phone, or whether there was one specific investigation you were involved with that they were looking into?
So actually, I was like running through all my email correspondences, trying to match the dates of when, you know, Pegasus was active on my phone to like what email I sent. I looked at my calendar, whom I was meeting. In the time frame when I was under surveillance, I sent 17 or 15 comment requests to the Hungarian government. 11 were followed up by a hacking into my phone. So what the Hungarian government did is that usually they ignored my comment requests, but after a few days, they just hacked into my phone, possibly to, you know, see what kind of story I'm actually working on. What I cannot tell, unfortunately, is what was the exact data they accessed. So I cannot tell that. What we know is the amount of data that was uploaded or downloaded from my phone. It was more than 100 megabytes, which is not that much. So
I think that those should have been text messages, emails, chats, chat logs,
but not, for example, videos. And also the other coincidence that I found out is that when I came under surveillance, I was working on a Russia-related story. It was about international bank. And the US, the UK, some NATO allies were freaking out because they thought that this bank is just a front for Russian espionage. But the Hungarian government, for some reason, didn't care about this threat. So I was working on this story when my surveillance started. And I'm pretty sure that this was the story that triggered my monitoring, because we also found the phone number of the Hungarian fixer of an American journalist who was working on the same story. And also, I was meeting with this journalist. I could tell from the analysis of my phone, the exact day when I was meeting with this American journalist, Pegasus was activated on my phone. You could pretty much reverse engineer the reasons why they started surveilling me. But
I don't know why they stayed on me for like 7 months. And I was working on a range of different stories. So basically, that's just my theory. The Hungarian intelligence agency got a surveillance permit to hack into my phone. They thought that, well, you know, why don't we stay there and just see what this guy is doing?
Your latest investigation traces how the Hungarian government managed to get hold of this software. And something that's immediately disturbing about it is that the Hungarian Parliament's National Security Committee voted unanimously for the intelligence services to be able to buy this software without needing to go through any kind of public procurement procedure. Is that just because this committee is like full of friends of Orbán, or is there something else going on here?
The problem with this committee is that it's made up by, you know, Orbán's MPs, so they pass anything they want. But what was really mind-boggling here is that even the opposition voted in favor of procuring Pegasus. Of course, there are some explanations to this. One is that when the Hungarian Intelligence Service requested this procurement, they didn't tell actually to the MPs what is the exact technology, what is the name, that it's called Pegasus. They didn't tell that it's manufactured by NSO Group. They just describe the capabilities of this spyware. But still, even given that, in earlier times, this committee was used to scrutinize such procurements, and at least the opposition had questions, and they forced the intelligence agencies to report later on how they used the new technology that they bought, but not this time. So it was a pretty careless and pretty ignorant attitude, even from the opposition. And I guess that just tells us a lot about when it comes to national security, and especially when it comes to surveillance, a lot of people are just really ignorant. They just think that this is something that can only happen to criminals, to terrorists. Ordinary people are not really in the scope of such intelligence gathering. But the reality is that if there's no real oversight, if there's no transparency, then essentially anyone can become target of surveillance. And this is what happened actually in Hungary, because close political allies of those MPs who sat in this committee from the opposition, 1 year later, their close allies became targets of surveillance. Their own people became surveilled by the Orbán government.
So this spyware that was brought into Hungary, it was brought in via a company called Communication Technologies Limited. I think you should always be suspicious.
That's like the most general name, yes.
Yes, and I always think you should be suspicious of companies with such generic sounding names. In your investigation, you point out that one of the owners is a close friend of the Interior Minister. Is this one of those examples of the cronyism that's become such a big problem in Hungary? People close to Orbán being handed really lucrative contracts.
Those people, I mean, at least one people behind the broker company that procured Pegasus is a former communist state police agent, someone whose job was to, you know, spy on the Hungarian citizens. The other problem is that this person is also the guy who used to oversee, who used to control the intelligence agencies. You know, this is the classic revolving door. The same guy who was in charge of the intelligence agencies, when he's leaving the state, he's becoming like a subcontractor of the state itself. So yes, this does look like a pattern where you can raise the issue with cronyism.
So the Pegasus story broke more than a year ago now, and the revelations about the Hungarian authorities' use of this spyware was one of just like many shocking parts of a huge international story. How much has changed since then? Like, do we know whether the Hungarian national security authorities have stopped using this kind of spyware?
When the scandal broke, the Hungarian state stopped using Pegasus, but only for a certain time. And after all the investigations in Hungary came up with the result that there's nothing to see here, these surveillances were all legal, then the surveillances with Pegasus were resumed. That's what I was told. I don't know if they are still using it at this time when we're speaking, but I wouldn't be surprised. At the same time, revelations were published about Poland, Spain, and currently the European Parliament is investigating this matter. There's an inquiry committee set up by the Parliament called the PEGA Committee. They just came up with a draft report, and they requested Europol to request national authorities in Hungary, Spain, Greece, Poland to take the matter seriously and launch new investigations.
It sounds like it was quite a big thing to go through for you, discovering that you were being tracked by the Hungarian state. And being an investigative journalist is hard enough and scary enough in any country. How have the risks attached to your job changed in recent years? Are there times when you think it's just too dangerous to carry on doing what you're doing?
No. I mean... There are far worse places than Hungary, and at least physically, journalists are safe here. You cannot tell the same thing about, for example, Slovakia, where an investigative journalist was murdered a couple of years ago, or Malta. Those types of violence against investigative journalists were, you know, of course, carried out by the mob, by violent criminals with links to the state. In Hungary, crime, violent crime, is not really a thing here. Of course, when you discover that the Hungarian state has such surveillance capabilities, of course, you understand that they have the power to, you know, go after anyone they want and to suppress risky elements, not just journalists, but also criminals. There is a real risk here, but this risk is more about our sources, not that much about the journalists. The real brave people here are those who have direct access to information about wrongdoing, abuses of power, corruption. I'm pretty sure that the reason why at least six journalists and photo reporters in Hungary were surveyed with Pegasus is that the Hungarian state wanted to find out who are the sources of these journalists, who are those people among their ranks, who are their subordinates, who out of different reasons decide to contact the journalists and tip them off, send them some documents.
Thank you very much to Szabolcs for joining us. His Twitter account is an excellent source of Hungarian news and analysis, and of course, investigations. You can find him at Panyi Szabolcs. The other thing that this conversation made me think about a lot is this wiretapping scandal that has been rocking Greek politics over the past few weeks. We haven't had a chance to talk about it yet on the show. Hopefully we will in the coming weeks. But in the meantime, I thought I would drop a background read on that into the show notes.
There's also a new case in the UK.
Phone hacking scandals. Turns out they're still very much alive and well in Europe. What have you been enjoying this week, Dominic?
Well, firstly, I wanted to mention that the latest visual episode in our own series that we are co-producing with Are We Europe? This is What a Generation Sounds Like, came out this week. It's called Denisa. You might remember hearing the audio version in your feeds last year. That audio piece produced by Andrei Popovicu and protagonist Denisa Habus has been so beautifully transformed into a visual piece by Eddie Stock. He has created beautiful and playful visuals that enhance the audio story. So go check it out in the link in the show notes. We'll also be posting it in the feed of our podcast over the next few weeks.
It's amazing. It gave me the chills.
It's really good. But also, because I've been sick, I've been on the sofa a lot. And I will quickly mention a really excellent Scottish crime TV drama, which I watched last weekend. It currently, I think, is only on British TV, on ITV, but I'm sure it will be traveling abroad soon. And it's based on a series of books by Val McDermott, which are available everywhere. So if you love the sound of it, then you could get the books while you're waiting or invest in a VPN. I didn't say that. What's a VPN?
You always tell me off for talking about VPNs on this show.
I don't even know what a VPN is. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a show called Karen Piri. And the reason why I wanted to talk about it here today is because it's a drama that follows a police force in Fife, the east of Scotland, that have to reopen an unsolved case from back in the 90s because a true crime podcast series looking into this case becomes incredibly popular and starts shining a light on some failures in the police's initial investigation. Mm. It's a really intriguing starting point for the series, and it's not just an intriguing starting point, it delivers really well. The woman who presents the true crime podcast in the series is a bit of a silly character and is often referred to as Podcast Lady, with some disparagement from Detective Sergeant Karen Piri and her colleagues. She's really irritating, the Podcast Lady. It's like a really bad depiction of podcasters. Oh. Anyway, apart from that, it's a great series. It has some lightness amidst the obvious dark, murderous topic, and I found it a really timely storyline just a few weeks after Adnan Syed was released from prison in the States, years after his case was brought to international attention in the most popular true crime podcast of all time, Serial. So keep an eye out for Karen Piri wherever you live. It's a big hit in the UK, so I'm sure it'll be traveling soon.
Nice, I'll check it out.
What have you been enjoying?
Well, I don't know if you're someone who follows these things, but the Nobel Literature Prize has just been awarded to a French author, Annie Ernaux, feminist icon. She has been writing novels since the 1970s, novels largely based around her own experiences as a woman from a working class background in Normandy. Very intimate experiences, often. Her first novel was about the abortion that she had as a student back in the 60s when it was still illegal. And she writes about love affairs. She writes about her parents getting older. She writes about life as a wife in super patriarchal 1970s France. Really personal experiences. And she writes in this very beautiful and accessible way. I actually think her novels are not a bad choice if you are learning French and you feel, yeah, like ready to tackle a novel, but maybe not one with super complicated vocabulary. Arnaud has been celebrated in France for like half a century, but her work has only been discovered in the English-speaking world really quite recently. It was after her book Les Années, The Years, got nominated for the Booker Prize in 2019. That feels like the moment when her work really became much better known in English. And actually, Les Années, The Years, that is the book that I want to recommend this week. I have to hold up my hands and tell you that I hadn't actually read any Annie Ernaux until this week. I am a very bad French person, but like everyone else, I ran out to the bookshop when she won the Nobel Prize and found that she was sold out because everyone wants to read her books. Mm-hmm. Luckily for me, her books are readily available as ebooks if you can't find them in the bookshop. And The Years is widely seen as her masterpiece. And even in the first few pages, I found something very profound and something that made me laugh out loud. I can confirm. Good choice by the Nobel Committee. Turns out Annie Ernaux's books are really, really good.
For this week's happy ending, I wanted to tell you about Dr. Federica Bertocchini. Federica is a scientist who works at the Biological Research Center in Madrid, and in her spare time, she is an amateur beekeeper. But Federica was having a problem with her beehives. They were infested with annoying wax worms. Ooh. Federica had to get rid of them, so she cleaned out the beehives and placed those pesky wax worms into some plastic bags. Sometime later, Federica noticed that said plastic bags had grown holes in them. The worms were getting out. Annoying, right?
Oh, no.
Well, no, not annoying, because it turned out she had just made an incredible scientific discovery. These worms, these larvae, were breaking down the plastic and pretty effectively, probably with their saliva.
Oh, I see where this is going. This seems helpful.
It could be so helpful. Is what Federica thought. So she went on to do a proper scientific study and discovered with her colleagues that the saliva of these pesky insects was possibly, quote, a depository of degrading enzymes which could revolutionize the disposal of plastic and potentially even the recycling of plastic. More work needs to be done, but it's very, very exciting nonetheless. And I found it so pleasing to hear that it was an accidental discovery involving a pest.
I've just Googled waxworms because I frankly never heard of them before. They are disgusting. But if they can eat plastic, more power to them.
Absolutely.
That is it for this week. And we wanted to give you a heads up that next week's episode is a really special one. Producer Wojciech is taking us to Georgia. I cannot wait for you to hear it. Do not miss it. In the meantime, we can be found tweeting at EuropeansPod, Instagramming pictures at Europeans Podcast. And if you've got any ideas for things that we should be talking about, you can drop us an email at hello@europeanspodcast.com.
This episode was produced by Katie Lee and Wojciech Oleksiak. We're sending loads of love and well wishes to Katz Laszlo, who is reporting from Ukraine at the moment. And we're hoping she stays safe, considering everything that's happening there right now. This podcast is part of the Are We Europe audio family. You can go and check out everything they do at areweeurope.eu.
See you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Tschüss.